Good morning. Welcome to the House Committee on Higher Education, Innovation, and Workforce Development. We have two legislators who are patiently waiting. We're going to start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 493. Senator Bates, Representative Buckley, please come forward. Victoria, give us a summary as they get settled, please.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 493 removes the ability of the governor to disband university governing board or force university to take other action if university fails to make timely compliance with conditions established when State Board of Higher Education endorsed governing board. Requires university that fails to comply with conditions to have governing board vote on whether to disband or retain governing board, declares emergency as effective on passage.
Thank you very much. Senator Bates, Representative Buckley, glad you're here. Please.
Chair Reed, thank you so much. I'm Representative Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson County in the Oregon House. Usually, and Senator Bates and I appear together, usually he's gracious enough to let me go first, and I do kind of stream of consciousness stuff, and then he comes behind and makes sense of it all.
Sounds like a good team.
Yeah, so it's worked out over the years. Thank you for your attention and consideration of this bill. Quite simply, what this bill does, it asks if the state will treat all seven university boards the same. That's all we're asking with this bill. Many of us have been through the discussions on the Oregon University system as it's transformed into institutional boards for the seven universities. The regional universities were the last ones to be considered. The effort to allow our institutions to have the same rights and responsibilities as the big three institutions was a multi-year effort, and the discussions were very frank. The discussions on shared services, discussions on how things would operate were very frank. But we've gotten to a place, colleagues, where we made an agreement as we were moving forward that there'd be certain sideboards that the regionals would have to meet, at least Southern and Eastern. We're meeting those requirements. There's a requirement currently that the governor would have the ability to kind of pull the plug on the institutional boards for Southern and Eastern, and we're asking for that to be removed, and again to have all seven institutions be treated the exact same. If it sounds like I have a bit of a chip on my shoulder, I do. This effort was extremely difficult to have our institutions treated with the same consideration and respect as other institutions. It got to the point, Mr. Chair, during one of the State Board of Higher Education meetings, after I had brought in Sid DeBoer, the CEO of Lithia Motors, one of the largest companies in the state, who testified on behalf of Southern. One of the board members from the State Board of Higher Ed made the comment that giving the regionals their own board was like giving a teenage driver the keys to the car. That kind of disrespect was just astounding to me. The regional universities are vital. They're vital to our state, and they're vital to our regions. And contrary to what might be perceived, not all wisdom resides in the Willamette Valley. We have very, very capable people in Southern Oregon. We have very, very capable people in Eastern Oregon. We have very, very capable people in Western Oregon as well, and Central Oregon as well. Thank you, Reverend Wisdom, for reminding me. So again, I hope I'm not offending anyone with this chip that I do have on my shoulder. But the intent behind this bill is to simply say, please, let's be fair, let's be respectful, and let's treat each institution and the board members of each institution the same. SOU, Eastern, they have very capable people they've recruited for their boards, and let's give them the same respect that we give to the board members of U of O, of PSU, and OSU, et cetera. If there should ever be a crisis at any one of our universities, SOU, Eastern, they'd be in the same position that any other university would be that had a crisis. So again, capable people being recruited to do a job for an institution that they love and they have passion for, please treat Southern and Eastern the same as every other institution with the same rights and responsibilities. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Buckley. Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I guess I'll key off the comment of giving the keys to the teenagers. One of those teenagers is Bill Thorndike. He's the chair of the board. He is a former member of the Federal Reserve Board out of San Francisco, served there for 7 or 8 years. I don't consider Bill Thorndike a teenager that is not knowing what's going on in the
except for his energy and creativity and dedication, right?
What I'm saying is we've got some very capable people in Southern Oregon, and they have stepped up and want to do this. This has been a 15-year goal for me, frankly. I always felt the Higher Ed Board didn't serve the needs of the regionals very well. We had a situation for a long time where The board had never been, no member of the board had been on the campus for over 3 or 4 years, and a lot of them didn't know where Roseburg or Medford were as far as which came first when you're driving south. I asked a couple of them, and they said they didn't know. It's just a disconnect that was not appropriate. So while my partner here and I for a while disagreed about whether we should have a regional board or not, I think he's there now, and even got a chip on his shoulder over it. So it shows the need for it. The Southern Oregon campus specifically is the only campus that has increased enrollment on campus for undergraduates. The school is now thriving. We've gone through something called retrenchment. We have a board that's very hands-on. This is not a board that meets every 3 months and has a cocktail party. These people are hands-on. We have a new president who's doing a great job, and the board supports him and works closely with him. We couldn't have this kind of a situation if we didn't have a local and really engaged board, and that's what's important about this. The one thing they have hanging over them is that at any moment they can be pulled out by a simple decision by the governor. We got a great governor right now, you know, does a wonderful job, but things could change. And as long as that board's doing its job and the school is thriving, they need this pulled off. It's very demoralizing for them to sit there putting huge amounts of their own time into it, volunteering their time with multiple meetings, to find out any morning they can wake up and the rug's been pulled out from under them. I've already had a discussion with the governor, and she is in favor of this bill. We had two discussions about it, so I believe she understands it well. And as Representative Buckley said, we just want to be treated fairly. Give us the same opportunity every other university has, and we'll get the job done. Just give us that opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bates. The committee had a good hearing on the retrenchment process last week and heard from President Saigo. I for one, was very impressed. I thought he came off very well. And President Kenton was here then and is here now, is going to follow you as well. Any questions for Representative Buckley or Senator Bates?
Well,
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you guys for being here. Appreciate it. You'll recall back, I think, both of you, to 2013, I believe, when we passed the legislation that enabled the governing boards, not just for the true, I mean, if you go back to, you know, memory lane or whatever, it was quite a lift even to get to give their top three or our flagship universities a governing board. That was some pretty innovative and plowing some new ground here within the state. You know, that was an open-ended question whether that was a good thing to do or not, and we had proponents and opponents on both sides of that. Then the conversation became, well, what about the other four, and how should we treat them the same, treat them differently, and there are all kinds of permutations on the table as we went through that session. I think it actually came down to the February, did it not? Was it 14, I believe? Where there was everything from, well, we'd create this kind of higher ed ESD to oversee the TRUs, provide a little hands-on guide, because again, some of them, Southern, Eastern, were in some, you know, tenuous situations at the time, versus completely cutting the apron strings and letting them go. So the language that we had or ended up with, I thought, provided some context, at least to the point that I don't think you would find a governor picking up the phone just, you know, on a whim and just saying, okay, your board's gone. There was a process in place, i.e. via audits and consultations with the HEC and so forth. So I don't think it's I don't think the board should live in fear and trembling that, you know, they would get a call just randomly that, you know, that their board would go away. But I guess my bigger question would be that if, in fact, this bill would go forward, what I don't see is what would be the next steps if the board themselves voted to disband. What then? Because I don't see any other governance in place here, any other methodologies that would help. Because again, the HEC is available, but they're not a governance entity. We don't want another OUS or OUS light at this point. So what's envisioned?
I guess Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, thank you. It'd be the same question if the Portland State Board dissolved. What would that then happen if Portland State, every university has had ups and downs. And I would say, and you've heard me say it, my apologies for repeating myself so often, but I think the major problems at Eastern and Southern were due to the funding levels the state provided and the fact that the State Board of Higher Education did not provide proper governance to those institutions. with the local boards. They will have the proper governance they need, and we're doing our best to try to get the funding levels for higher ed to a place that there's some sustainability there. But so my short answer is it's the same situation if OIP's board should decide to dissolve or Eastern's board should decide to dissolve. We don't have in statute right now a solution to that. So again, I would ask the committee to treat the SAU and Eastern boards with the same respect as the other boards. And if the question is necessary to resolve in terms of what would happen in that situation, we need to resolve for all seven institutions.
Mm-hmm. And I would offer, too, that if the board decided to dissolve itself, the president will still be in place, the administration will still be in place, the school will continue to function, and they'd always have to come back to us and talk about governance. Mm-hmm. And so that part wouldn't change. There'd be a wider range of decisions to be made at that point. Do you join a bigger institution? Do you stay independent? All kinds of things would be part of that discussion. But it doesn't mean the institution can't function and take care of its student and graduate people. That would not change. Mm-hmm. There's a governance board that gives direction and input and can really be helpful to the school. And frankly, at times, can probably do some fundraising. But it wouldn't mean the end of the school if they dissolved.
Just to follow up, Mr.
Please.
Chair. So maybe I'm not clear on this, but did the language specifically regarding the governor's ability to remove the board pertain only to Eastern and Southern? My impression it was all the truths, but is that incorrect?
Chair Reeve, Representative Johnson, it was just Eastern and Southern.
Okay. That helps. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Representative Rudin.
Does any of this discussion affect the continuation of the shared services?
Chair Reed, Representative Reed, no, it doesn't. The shared services, and I have to say, Senator Bates alluded to this, I was very reluctant as this whole process started out of concern that the truths were going to get, the Technical Regional University were going to get somehow mistreated in this process of breaking up the system. And I have to say the universities have addressed that fear quite remarkably. Their sense of collaboration, believe it or not, has increased rather than decreased given the move to institutional boards. And the shared services issue would not change under this bill. The same process, it would still remain in place where the universities are collaborating. The HEC is now part of the shared services are now part of the formula that the HEC has put forward for funding the universities. So this does not change that situation.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, I just want to, I'm not sure why the bill is confined or restricted to Eastern and Southern, but to me, the bill really addresses an underlying principle of equity, and I think that we need our universities, our community colleges, in terms of innovation and workforce development. We need to rely on these institutions, and we need to make sure that there's collaborative environments in which these institutions can work together. So, appreciate the principle that this is bringing.
Representative Reed, Representative Davis. The bill only applies to Eastern and Southern because only Eastern and Southern have these restrictions placed upon them. OIT and Western both have their institutional boards without any kind of sword hanging over their head. So if this bill passes, all four regional universities will be treated the same.
Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, committee.
We have three people to testify. April and I'm not sure if it's Sebsic, perhaps. Please. Dennis Slattery and President Kenton.
You get the middle. Thank you.
And I think you made it to the dais first, so if you'd like to start, we'd be glad to hear from you. If you could start with your name for the record, that'd be great,
I will
particularly
do so.
Since I probably mispronounced it.
Thank you, Chairman. I'm April Sevig. I'm the vice chair of the new Southern Oregon University Board, and I'm here representing our entire board. Bill Thorndike sends his regrets. He couldn't be here. And our president as well could not make it today. He had a family emergency that he needed to be home. So please accept the apologies because this is incredibly important to us. Chairman Thorndike and I have worked together for more than 40 years on various organizations. They're all in good health now. Our hospital, our manor, our county, fiscally, we have done the things that needed to be done. And as Senator Bates said, for 15 years, we have wanted control because we knew we could do a better job. Because not casting doubt on anyone else, but we care deeply about our students, about our faculty, about our university, and we will make it a success. We won't be voting to disband. We will be successful, and we'd like this sword removed from our heads. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's very concise. Who's next?
Thank you, Chairman Reed, representatives, for this unique opportunity in my life. I am Dennis Lattery. I'm on the Board of Trustees for Southern Oregon University. I'm also the faculty member and an alumni. We are here on that issue of equity, and well, we think it's a proper issue, and we support the passage of this bill. I can't say enough about the board that we have. I've served as president of the chamber in Ashland, so I cross over from academia to the business community. I also served as a city councilor in Ashland, and when April says failure's not an option, failure's not an option, this is our school, we take it very personally. And but in the rare case that it would happen, I'm sure that we would know, and we would take the steps best for the university. And so thank you. I think that's enough. I should be concise. Follow up on it.
Thank you, Mr. Slattery. We may have questions for you, so don't go anywhere. President Kenton, please.
Chair Reed, members of the subcommittee, for the record, my name is Jay Kenton. I'm the interim president at Eastern Oregon University. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 493, which would effectively change the remedies for the conditions on the governing boards of EOU and Southern. I'm not here because I think EOU will have any troubles complying with these board conditions, but rather to ensure that the EOU Board of Trustees, comprised of well-intentioned individuals, has the full opportunity to work to guide the institution, not unlike that present at the other five institutions that formerly comprised the Oregon University system, as well as the 17 community colleges and OHSU. I firmly believe that a local board would not allow the institution to falter in the same way a statewide board could. The fiduciary role of this board, coupled with the familiarity with the institution and its leadership team, will simply not allow the situation to recur and thereby make these conditions unnecessary. I am also not here to say I distrust the governor. The governor is a person I have known and found to be extraordinarily fair in her dealings. Thus, I want her to know that I mean no disrespect by supporting this bill. EOU's conditions revolve around, one, its enrollment, and while it has declined in the last 2 years, our applications are currently up over 20% for next year. Two is finances. We cut $4 million in 14-15 and are closely managing our revenues and expenditures to rebuild our liquidity and institutional reserves, diversify our revenues, and limit our long-term debt. And three, we have also restructured our faculty and staff workloads and are in the process of realigning our curriculum with the needs of the region and state. In summary, we are improving on all the metrics specified in the board conditions and will continue to do so whether this bill is passed or not. Also, per the statutes already in place, all public higher education institutions must now be evaluated annually by the HEC. Thus, EOU would be evaluated annually along with the other 24 or 25 institutions the HEC coordinates. Having yet another independent assessment or evaluation seems redundant. It is a new day in Oregon higher education. We have embarked on a new structure for our higher education system. All institutions deserve to have the full opportunity to work with their local boards for the success of their institutions, their regions, and the state as a whole. The best means to accomplish these objectives is to allow 8 public universities and 17 community colleges to function unrestrained with their new boards, with a level playing field, and without unreasonable constraints. I would urge your support of this bill and ensure you that you will not be disappointed with this decision. Thank you, and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. President. Questions for this panel? Representative, was that you?
Chairman, so I have a question on the bill on page 2 of the bill when you get down to line 24, 25, 26. Basically, is taking away the section where the governing board can disband this, but it's putting in there the governing board shall meet and vote on whether the university should retain or disband the governing board. Is that the governor's board making that vote, or is that the university board's making that vote in the bill?
I'm just catching up with you. Can you point me to
page
the line
two,
again? Page
2, line, the new language, basically the meat of the bill, if, as I read
yes.
it, 24, 25, and 26.
Yep. Any of you have a perspective on that? We can take that up offline if you don't, but we appreciate your perspective on it, too.
Chair Reed, Representative Hayden, my read of the bill was it takes it from the governor's decision and gives it to the EOU or SOU Board of Trustees to decide on next steps. And given your previous question to the senator and representative who were here before me, you know, I could see a board deciding, well, we need to merge with another entity or something else. And obviously that would take some action, I believe, on the part of the legislature or the governor to make that happen. But, you know, there are alternatives that I think a board could explore should they get into that situation.
Representative Hayden, does that help?
It's still a little unclear to me, but so is it the universities that are getting together the voting, or is it it looks like it's the governor's board that's getting this bill requires that the governor board gets together and
the
votes.
Governing board?
Is that governing board.
The governing board.
Yep.
Us. That's
yeah.
them.
Yeah.
Gets together and votes whether to disband that or not.
Yeah, that's my understanding. I'm happy to be corrected that it's essentially giving the power to the governing board. And I guess that's the full end of the sentence.
So, okay, my question was, so it's not actually taking the ability away, but it's giving them the ability to vote on whether to take that ability away.
I think that's right. Giving
and so we're
giving
assuming
the board full
that they
autonomy.
Would vote to do that.
Well, I think that would be the decision for the board to make,
okay.
Based on their read of what's in the best interest of the institution.
Yeah, Chair Reed, Representative Hayden, my read is that the HEC will still do an evaluation based on the conditions, and that they would notify then the governing board.
Triggers the process.
That, you know, the institution was not in compliance or, you know, was out of compliance with those conditions, and the governing board would then take action on that notification.
And Representative Hayden, the bill is posted for public hearing. We're not yet ready to, we won't be able to move it today. My intention is to schedule for a work session at our next meeting. So there'll be time to follow up with more clarity
okay.
as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Other questions, Representative Johnson?
Well, along that line, Mr. Chair, is there a definition of retain or disband? Would it be possible for a board to vote to, in effect, the members resign, but the board framework remains, and therefore the governor then could appoint a new governing board in place of those members who, for whatever reason, chose to leave the institution or leave their role. Mm-hmm. It's not clear to me that maybe there's a legislative language that would make that clear, but I don't know. I mean, I could see a scenario where a board was just so, you know, fed up with the situation, mm-hmm. didn't like the micromanagement, whatever, and said, well, here, you appoint mm-hmm. new people and do it your way. It's not clear to me that this language means the board necessarily, as an institution, or entity of the institution, goes away. It could simply mean that the personnel resign. Maybe then it provides that opportunity for reappointment. I don't know.
Maybe I'm oversimplifying, but it seems that it would, in that case, the action of the members of the board in resigning would affect only their presence on the board, not the existence of the board.
That's my point.
Yeah, that's the way I would read it as well. Let's follow up on that too. Are we right on that, do you think? Okay. We're getting nods. Okay. Other questions for this panel? I don't see you.
Actually, Chair, I don't think it's a question for this panel, but in line 27 of page 2, there's a reference to the State Board of Higher Ed. Should that be the HEC? Is there a little cleanup that we might need to do with that language also?
That's a good observation. I don't know the answer to that, but we'll look into that.
I believe there is another bill that cleans up all references.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Let's check on that as well. Thank you. Good catch, Representative McEwen. Thank you for that. Okay. I think we've exhausted our questions. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
That completes the list of people who have signed up to testify. Is there anyone else who'd like to be heard on Senate Bill 493?
I wonder.
Representative Johnson?
Well, we do have a few members of the HEC here. I wonder if it's possible to provide a little context about how the seven boards actually exist and perhaps any language that may delineate different treatment.
Fannin, it sounds like you're being summoned.
If he would have that committed to memory.
He can probably do it in one breath.
But the... the issue into context.
Sure. Maybe. Good suggestion. Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director for the HEC, remind me not to stop by your hearings.
Don't stop by.
Just for fun.
You can watch from remote. It's safer.
The question?
Representative Johnson, you want to restate your question, please?
Well, again, just to clarify, I guess, did we statutorily create a different scenario for Eastern and Southern Oregon University? And then perhaps also the process of we had the major flagship universities that were approved for their board initially, I think in Senate Bill 270, correct? Then we came back in February that extended that opportunity to the other TRUs. But just where was that delineation of different treatments to the different institutions, if you could?
Representative Johnson, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll do my best to recall as you're doing the process. You're right that the initial work of 270 was to establish institutional boards for the three large universities. Interestingly, and it's really a side note, OSU was treated slightly differently than PSU and U of O. It was provided with an option that the president exercised not long after the bill's passage to create that institutional board, but it was an option that that OSU sought and exercised. And the legislature then the following year, I believe, created the ability for Eastern, Southern, OIT, and Western to establish boards essentially on the same terms and conditions with identical authorities as OSU, PSU, and U of O, except for the provisions that you're dealing with now. And those were the provisions that pertain specifically to Southern and to Eastern, where the State Board of Higher Ed, at that time their governing board, and the institution had to agree on a set of conditions that would be associated with the creation of their governing board. So the legislature essentially said, you may have a governing board if you agree to accept conditions that the State Board of Higher Ed proposes. And they went ahead after the passage of the legislation and essentially negotiated. The leaders of those two institutions negotiated with the State Board of Higher Ed and agreed to a set of conditions that triggered the creation of their institutional boards, the governor's subsequent appointment of members. Those boards have all the same authorities and responsibilities as the boards of University of Oregon, Portland State, and the others. But there are these conditions, and the conditions require monitoring in the first year by the State Board of Higher Ed. That's winding up now. That monitoring responsibility transitions to the HEC, and as you're seeing in the language that you're looking at today, the HEC is responsible for notifying the governor, and if the bill passes, the institutional boards as well, of their of whether or not they're continuing to meet those conditions, and then of course, if they're not, the provisions in the original language or in the bill, should it become law, apply. So I think your recollection of the history is correct. The language you're looking at now is, to my knowledge, the only way in which the Southern and Eastern are treated differently under the law than the other five. And assuming they're successful meeting of the conditions by, I think, 2017 is when it wraps up. Assuming they've successfully met, they will be in every way identical under the law to University of Oregon's board, Oregon State's board, Portland State University's board.
Thanks for that context, that helps a lot. Representative Johnson.
A follow-up then, too. I'm relying on memory again, but is there not a provision in, wasn't in Senate Bill 270 for the governor to also remove individual? I mean, they serve at the pleasure of the governor, appointed by the Senate, obviously. But I think there's a provision in there, too, that the governor could intervene.
In fact, that's the summary of the bill here, removes ability of governor to disband university governing board.
Representative Johnson, Mr. Chair, I think you're referring to really the chartering language for the boards, all seven boards
right.
now, which provides, of course, the governor with the ability to appoint and the Senate to confirm. That's true now for all seven boards. I don't recall specifically what the governor's authorities are for removal of members. Every board and commission mm-hmm. has some, that's governor appointed, has some language, or at least there's some understanding about what the governor's ability is to remove someone from the board. I believe that the language in 270 provides for that ability, but limits it in order to minimize the, and Victoria's nodding her head, in order to minimize the possibility that a governor or a new governor would
Correct.
Sort of come in and make sweeping changes. So I think it's limited to several removals in a year. I do think,
right.
I think the governor, this is an opportunity for me to point out what I think has gotten at times sort of misconstrued about these so-called independent boards. They're governor-appointed boards. I mean, if you're focused on public accountability for these institutions, as I think you and we all ought to be, yes, there's HEC monitoring, there's the conditions for Southern and Eastern. Ultimately, these are public institutions because they're run by publicly appointed governor-appointed boards, the same way that my commission is publicly is appointed by the governor and is a public entity. And so I think it's important to acknowledge, yes, we have provided much greater levels of autonomy for these boards and institutions, but they remain accountable in the same way that many other institutions in the state that are run by governor-appointed boards are accountable. And I know that this governor takes that responsibility very, very seriously.
Thank you. I think that covers it for today.
Well, I guess
Representative Johnson.
The only other question then, I guess, is the one I asked earlier, and that would be, can you envision a situation where there could be, we could have six universities with governing boards and one without, with a president managing a campus, and how might that interact, or is that sustainable, or do we need to consider some sort of legislative, whatever, ability to step in and create some sort of new framework?
Representative Johnson.
This is personal opinion. I'm not
sure. Chair Reed. Yeah, I really don't. I mean, we've examined so many different governance structures over the past several years for universities, looked at so many states with different models for governance. I would at least suggest that there may be issues associated with a public institution that does not have a governing board. It would immediately raise questions, for example, about the hiring of the president. I think that I think previous speakers alluded to this, likely legislative intervention would be necessary if we did find ourselves in a situation where there was a university governing board that had sort of fully disbanded and there were no replacements for those members. I mean, you'd have an issue. We would have an issue, I think, to deal with. Clearly, that's not anticipated or expected under this bill. I think that would create a challenge, a governance challenge. But I should also say there are a lot of different models that can work. As you know from our work on 270, there's not a single sort of right answer to governance.
I suppose that's one of the advantages of annual sessions. If we did get into that situation, we could respond more quickly. Victoria, you found the confirmation on that earlier question?
Actually, Dana found it.
Okay.
The governor can remove no more than three members in 4 years, but for misconduct.
Other questions? Comments? Thank you for
Thanks.
Being here and answering answering so many unexpected questions. I think that covers Senate Bill 493 for today. As I mentioned before, we're scheduled only for a public hearing for today, so we will put it on for a work session coming up. If you have additional comments or clarifications, please be in touch or other things you want us to be aware of before we get that scheduled for a work session. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 493.
and open an informational meeting. The title here, Developing a Strong Innovation and Entrepreneurship Ecosystem, as right Mr. Stafford and Mr. Galper forward. We've heard from Ms. Stafford a couple of times in the committee so far, but now that she's a veteran of her role in the Innovation and Entrepreneurship Division at Business Oregon, we wanted to invite her back. And Kant Galper will, of course, introduce himself, but I believe it's the first time we've had an entrepreneur in residence at Business Oregon, so I was eager to have him come and educate the committee on some of what they're doing and some of what they have planned. So glad you're here. Thanks for being patient as we work through a bill. We're eager to hear from you.
Thank you. So Chair Reed and members of the committee, my name for the record is Heather Stafford, Assistant Director of Innovation and Entrepreneurship at Business Oregon. And today we'd like to kind of just walk you through. This isn't a tactical conversation. We're not talking about specific programs, but I'd rather paint a picture of the environment that we're looking at with innovation and entrepreneurship and make this more of a discussion. So as you know, looks like some of the formatting didn't translate, so apologies for that. As you know, Business Oregon is embracing a grow our own approach, which doesn't have anything to do with Measure 91. It's just grow our own. So looking at the fact that 70% of jobs are coming from companies that already exist in the state, and the reality that we really only have two Fortune 500 companies, notable ones in the state.
It seemed to be three, I heard.
I did.
Yeah, from your part of the state, too.
So growing, but it's, growing our own, we're looking at creating sustainable and resilient communities that create economic prosperity all over, that touch all parts of the state. And what would that look like? How do we create something like that? What we do in general, the building blocks of economic development as far as Business Oregon looks at them, is expansion, startup, and recruitment. And where our Office of Innovation and Entrepreneurship Development really play is in that startup phase. So looking at how to help companies get off the ground, how do you create an environment where companies can thrive and where access to capital is plentiful and mentoring is plentiful? How does that look? How do you create a sort of economic gardening approach to building that? So I will sort of shamelessly use growing and farming metaphors, because I think they make a lot of sense. I think they ground us in the reality of what we're looking at to grow our own and how you create an environment. Creating a replicable model that works all across the state is a challenge. There's at least seven distinct, not only geographic regions, but different cultures and communities. And a one-size-fits-all approach, it will never work for our state. This sort of the diversity that makes Oregon wonderful is also the challenge in creating something that you can just create once and replicate it everywhere and works for everyone. So we have to get a little creative with these communities to figure out how to grow these ecosystems. With that term, I'll actually just define some terms as we look at them. So an ecosystem, by dictionary definition, is a biological community of interacting organisms and their physical environment. It's also in the dictionary to refer to this as an entrepreneurial ecosystem. What happened in Silicon Valley is certainly an ecosystem, and what we're looking to do is create one that works for Oregon. Another term I'd like to define is innovate. A lot of times innovation gets attached to technology, and that's not how we see it. We look at how do you make changes in something that's established by introducing new methods, ideas, products, and how do you inspire that kind of innovation? And entrepreneur is really comes from a French word, and it's one who undertakes or one who takes on. So a person in business is who assumes the risk, who often is really out there creating something out of nothing. So to begin with the farming metaphors, any farmer looking at a plot of land that was perhaps barren would take these steps in creating a thriving ecosystem on that farm. First, they would assess the land and looking at what had grown there historically, what traits and properties that they have, what kinds of resources, and we look at this in workforce with economic development through what culture is there, what workforce exists, what strengths exist in that community that you can build off of already, so that you're not trying to overlay something that doesn't already fit and that aren't strengths. And then one would till the soil, so to speak. So investigating, really digging in a little bit, communicating with those folks in that ecosystem, find some champions, assign some roles, start building a plan, do some bonding, get a real sense of a team together that is looking at how to build this ecosystem and who's willing to do the work. And at most of the time, it's going to be volunteers from the outset. So then you would look, once you've tilled the soil a bit, you kind of understand what you have, then you would work on enriching it. So you'd work on bringing in speakers, education, training. You'd find your mentors in the community, any investors that you had or business professionals. You might hold meetups. You might build lists. And then you'd want to keep it up because pace is really important. So just keeping the conversation going around entrepreneurship and innovation is really important. So then all of that happens before you ever really think about planting the seeds. And it's really important to have fertile ground, I would say, before you start trying to accelerate or incubate companies. And so, you know, recruiting, you raise the bar, you set expectations with what industries you're looking at. And that sort of tough love and nurture growth is combined. You know, you really have to hold people to a high standard. Starting your own business is tough. And then inspire them, you know, bring that sort of food and light in to let them grow and then continue to feed and water them, which is where I think finally everyone wants to sort of sometimes start with an incubator or accelerator. And I think those are most effective once the ecosystem is a bit built, and then you can bring that in as a structure and say, you know, you bring mentoring, incubation, acceleration, you network these companies together with other mentors, you can promote them, be a virtual marketing team for them, and then also make sure that they get funding. So in that environment and looking at how we might do this effectively that touches all parts of the state, we're looking at three buckets of work, and the first one is innovation. And we're looking at all the way from STEM education to makers and inventors, university tech transfer, research and development, which includes patents and prototyping, and federal grants from SBIR or early stage commercialization grants, or even USDA value-added food producer grants, things like that. Then the second bucket of work is entrepreneurship, and we look at that with our network of existing incubators and accelerators, your technical service providers, those people who are working with small businesses already, your small business development centers, economic development districts, and then networks of investors, mentors, consultants, those folks that are working really boots on the ground directly with the entrepreneurs. How can we bring a little bit more connective tissue, I think, to those resources from the state perspective, so that they're all speaking more often and functioning more effectively. And the third one would be capital. And we have, you know, community capital or crowdfunding and Kiva and Kickstarter type stuff, which is where companies are going to get off the ground sometimes. There's a new rule change, which is an interstate exemption, and that is very nascent. It's been 4 months, but you know, $200,000 has been raised so far by private, unaccredited, or regular, everyday people. So it's an interesting tool that a lot of states are looking at using that gives us some opportunities, especially that are relevant in rural, where they've long not had access to those kinds of resources and that kind of capital. And then the investments that we make through the Oregon Growth Board, so leveraging funds into microfinance funds, seed funds, angel contests, and angel groups that function year-round, and also venture capital. So I want to just take a little tour through what we look at all the time, which is the technology, what I would say, revolution that's upon us. And we had the opportunity to be in Santa Clara and listen to Vivek Wadhwa speak, who's at Stanford and Singularity University, kind of a futurist with these things. And he said the most important skill of the future will be the ability to learn and adapt. And so how do we create a structure that has very little structure, right? How do we do this? This is new work, right? This is it changes every day, and you have to be responsive to those changes and agile. And it really revolves around Moore's Law, which was the fact that computing power doubles every 2 years since 1970. And what really an example of that is that, to, you know, hobbyists build drones in their garages right now, and a poor person in India right now is accessing the internet through a smartphone, whereas in 1985, that same computing power would cost $17.5 million and weighed 5,500 pounds.
I got to interrupt a little bit. There's a column some of you may have seen last week. Tom Friedman in the New York Times said, what would Moore's Law be like if it had been applied to cars? He said a 1971, if you start with a 1971 Beetle and apply it, the car now would go 300,000 miles an hour, 2 million miles per gallon, and cost 4 cents. So, it's a nice another bit of perspective to add to yours.
So this is what's upon us. So that, you know, many are predicting that Moore's Law can't continue, that it's that we're reaching a precipice where the computing power and the development of technology is going to not even be trackable. I mean, it's reaching where some people call it a singularity event, or there's, you know, where technology is so accessible to the masses that it fundamentally changes the way that we live. And so what would that look like? I mean, we've got right here at 2015, we're right just at the bottom part of what looks like an exponential curve. So how do you rein that in? How do you choose when these technologies like sensors and grid technologies, which I'll go into a little bit, are touching almost every part of life? Which one do you pick, right? How do you create an ecosystem that can support those kinds of changes? So the first one I think is interesting, I'll just kind of breeze through these slides, is 3D printing. There's incredible innovation happening in 3D printing. They've 3D printed a car that drives. I mean, they're 3D printing clothes. They've printed food, that's candy on the bottom left, and they're 3D printing pizzas.
And you decided to put a picture of a 3D printed shoe that was not made in Oregon? But there are some other options for that, that example.
Okay, well, I'll pick the better picture next time. This has implications in healthcare. They're 3D printing skin and hearts, organs, various things, and in China, they're 3D printing houses. They 3D printed this mansion in China for $160,000. They've 3D printed many more. So there's implications in construction and what we think of as innovation. You know, maybe we bypass very many things and go straight to 3D printing our homes. And do they even need to look like this anymore, right? These are questions that that entrepreneurs and innovators all over are going to be exploring.
Representative Johnson, the contractor, any perspectives on 3D printing homes?
Okay. 3D contractors, too?
Probably right.
Yeah.
Right. We have a capital issue here, too.
I just have to ask. I mean, the home is, it's either a really big 3D printer or your
small blocks.
Components of the home, right?
Yeah, they have actually, what they did with the car and what they also did with the home is they have 3D printers now that go on tracks, right?
Okay.
They're sort of giant 3D printers.
Oh.
And I think they're experimenting with the materials. I'm not exactly sure what that is. I think it was actually concrete.
Representative Wisdom.
You know, this is a technology. I'm not sure I agree with Mr. Moore. I mean, I think it's going to go bigger and bigger. I mean, and the gun, I mean, the 3D printing was, what, a year and a half ago? It's terrible. You can print you can make a gun with a 3D printer. Mm-hmm. And now we're making organs. I mean, this. I'm not sure I agree that it can't keep doubling or tripling. Or
no, whatever. I think, frankly, I think Moore's Law is obsolete.
Yeah.
I think it's more than doubling every year.
Yeah.
I think it's going beyond that. It's kind of obsolete.
Yeah. And the committee members, we're not using it in education in the state that has the worst graduation rate in the nation. End of comment. Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
So this has implications in transportation. Google already has test routes for their self-driving cars. You've seen these in various other places as well. But one of the quotes from Vivek Wadhwa was, you know, in 5 or 10 years, it'll be illegal for humans to drive a car because we're so messy. You know, you get in and you have a cocktail and you drive around and you switch lanes and you cause accidents where the future doesn't quite look like it may do that. So you see these folks lounging around working while their car is driving them to where their destination is, which I'm sure sounds nice to all of us, but it's still a new concept. As well with transportation are sort of high-speed electric rail type things, commuter airplanes that are in development. Some of them even you can land, the wings fold up, and you can just continue to drive. And so, you know, these are things that are being developed in partnership here in Oregon as well. So how do we embrace some of those types of innovations? Robotics is a huge topic, and you know, I sort of thought by this point we would have had a Rosie or, you know, some personal robot or something that helped us. But these are actually this Christmas being rolled out in several Amazon warehouses, and their estimate is that they'll be able to scan at least 300 items per hour with no human workers. And there's only 100 when the robot army, they're calling it, wasn't used. And so it avoids 20 miles of walking each day for those employees. They can streamline what they're doing. There's also, which we get a little bit more scientific, sci-fi and a little intimidating, and I'm not advocating one way or the other for any of these technologies. I'm just saying these are in development. But is nanorobotics, which has healthcare implications, you know, at a micro scale. These can do surgeries. They can perform functions at a cellular level that are really being looked at. There's also the whole artificial intelligence conversation, which is face recognition, complicated scheduling, or computer games. They basically are really innovating around this, but there's also, you know, the popular culture's fear of sort of, if, you know, the Avengers Age of Ultron scenario, where if we develop this and we're not conscious in how we create it, what happens then, right? There's a lot of responsibility that comes with these technologies, and so it's really important to develop them well. And then you've got Internet of Things, which is a term that gets used a lot, I think, but it really just means a connected world. You know, when sensors connect various things, you can control from one or two devices all your appliances, lighting, cameras, home, any objects, things you do at work, your cars, track your pets, turn your appliances on and off, all from a remote station. But obviously there's cybersecurity kinds of implications with that as well. So some of this is not limited by our ability to develop these technologies, but whether or not they're appropriate for society. And so I think that's the precipice we find ourselves in sometimes. There's wearable tech, which they, you know, stickers that sense, you know, fruit and vegetables, and you've got food safety issues. There's entertainment and virtual reality, fashion. I mean, it's touching all parts of this already. This is from Cisco from 2014, just at the amount of devices, so the millions of connected wearable devices that they're predicting by 2018. And you can just see that this sort of exponential curve just is represented in a variety of these industries, including precision farming and ag tech, which I think is really interesting for the state of Oregon. You look at the upper right picture, and it's really shows a picture of sort of the connected farm, you know, where a farmer has the ability to monitor the entire farm in real time and understand what's happening. You've also got aeroponics, vertical growing, aquaponics, which produces also protein, and then robotics for harvesting. So these things are already out there and on the market. They're not widely adopted because, you know, various reasons. But I think that Oregon has a strong ability to innovate in this particular area as well. From my experience working with entrepreneurs, I see that there's a strong interest here. So that's it for me. That's kind of want to leave you with the technology picture and let Kant Gopalpour, who's our entrepreneur in residence at Business Oregon, talk just briefly about his experiences here and what he sees.
Thank you very much, Heather. So good overview, Mr. Gopalpour. Thank you for being here again. If you could, I imagine you're also going to introduce yourself a little bit. I've had the good fortune to know something about your previous efforts, but the committee may not. So I hope you'll tell us that too.
Sure.
Thanks.
Morning, everybody.
Morning.
Morning, Chair. Morning, members of the committee. As Heather mentioned, my name is Kant Gopalpour, and I'm currently the entrepreneur in residence for Business Oregon. I'll get to that in a little minute. Just a background about myself. I moved to Oregon about 25 years ago because we drove around the country and liked Oregon, and moved to Portland without jobs, without knowing anybody. Started working at a small place up in Portland called Powell's Books, and saw an opportunity there, and got Powell's Books online in 1993. This is even before there were websites around. So people could auto use FTP, use Gopher, and actually place orders for books, and we would ship it to them. So after that started the website, we bootstrapped everything. We had to get revenues to grow and fund the business. Right after that, in the height of the .com area, I moved to a company called Django's, which has the distinction of being one of the biggest flameouts in Oregon in the .com industry. We, I think, went through like $23 million in 1 year. So it taught us a lot about capital. And after that, having learned that, I started my own company called Monsoon, which is to help small and medium-sized businesses grow online. I found it interesting that Business Oregon logo, the one Heather showed, was very similar to what my company's logo was, but it was all about growing businesses. Mm. So there's some synergy there. I raised some angel capital, mostly in Oregon, and then sold to a private equity group in 2010. So interesting enough, I've been through all stages of capital formation, right from bootstrapping to angels to venture to private equity. Now I'm an angel investor. I invest primarily in early stage companies that most predominantly don't have revenues, mostly in technology, mostly software. We're a loose group of us called Thai Angels, and we invest. We're one of the most active investors in the state right now, angel investors, and we have a pretty good return as well. I think we've got a 55% IRR over the past 3 years since we've been investing. We've invested in about, I'd say, close to 35 companies right now, spent a little over $4 to $5 million of our money. So, like I mentioned, I've been very involved in the ecosystem, mostly in the Portland area for the past 10 years. And I'm happy to say that we've come a long ways from where I was when I was starting my company 10 years ago. I think we've got a very vibrant ecosystem in Portland. I'm glad and honored to have played a part of this. I was on the OGA board for about 5 or 6 years. I was also in the intermediary fund, which created the Portland Seed Fund, which is doing good work in Portland and outside of Portland as well. I'm also a mentor to several startups. I've been a board member on a lot of companies, still sit on a few companies, including the James Beard Public Market, which you'll hear about, I'm sure, in the coming years. I speak about entrepreneurship and capital formation around the state. I've been to all the angel conferences up and down the I-5 corridor. So I've learned a lot. And my most recent endeavor, one which I'm really proud of, we started a youth entrepreneurship program for high school students, really from freshmen to seniors, with the idea of helping them learn how to grow and scale businesses. The idea being, how do we create the next generation of business leaders in Oregon? We put them through an 8-month process. These were all volunteers. We raised money from individuals and from some foundations, got this program up and running. We had a competition, and we're sending the winner to a global competition at the end of June. And the winner happened to be 5 students who built a drone, which can actually fly, has a 50-pound payload, and they do spot treatment in farms, on small to mid-sized farms. So it was fascinating to work with these kids. They actually built a prototype, a working prototype. And we are working with them right now to really teach them the fundamentals. Okay, you've got a great product, and how do we scale this? Because business plans, honestly, are outdated. Nobody really reads business plans anymore. So it's, you know, how do you get an idea? How do you validate it with the customer first before you go about building anything? Don't worry about putting together a business plan, because basically you just need to be good in PowerPoint and Excel to do that, right? You've got to really understand your business. So that's what we're teaching these kids. And it's I think that's a perfect complement to the STEM initiatives which are happening today. But what you also need to teach is, in addition to that, how do you become successful in business? I ran a software company. I've got a master's in government and international studies. It has nothing to do with what I studied, but it has to do with how you think. And I think that's really very, very important. So we're doing a lot with all of that. And I wanted to give back to the state. The state's been good to me, and I felt an obligation to give back. And so when I met with Sean Robbins a few months ago, and Representative Chair Reed was there as well, following that meeting, I volunteered to help in any capacity I could. And so here I am, the first entrepreneur in residence, I believe, for any state in the country. I think it's a really good move. It shows a lot. I know many other states are trying similar initiatives, but us being front, I think, just sends a message to the entrepreneurial community that Oregon is serious about innovation and entrepreneurship. So what do I do? You know, what does this all mean? It's a new position, so we're still working it out. As Heather mentioned, we're still looking at assessing the land right now. I consider myself as having two main roles. One is to be an ambassador between the startup community and the state. I believe I'm sometimes I'm at odds with my entrepreneurial colleagues, but I do believe the state has a role in fostering innovation entrepreneurship. We need to set a framework, and that's going to be really challenging because, as you just heard from Heather, innovation, we need to be able to learn and adapt as quickly as possible. And sometimes structures, even though they're built with the best intent, inhibit us. So it's finding that balance between setting structures, setting legislation, but also adapting as quick as things move, because nobody can really predict where things are going to be 10 years from now. It's really impossible. So you've got to be very opportunistic. So how do we create the structure where we can be opportunistic, I think, is a big challenge for us. But it also provides opportunities. If we can break through that, I think we can become a lot more nimble and agile. I also see myself being a policy advisor and bridging the gap, again, between the needs of the entrepreneur, the needs of the innovation ecosystem here, and state. So as I look around, I think I see a lot of strengths as well in Oregon, which I think we should capitalize on. I think if we can replicate Portland. I think Portland, 10 years ago, like I said, it was pretty bleak. You know, people didn't coordinate with each other. People didn't communicate well with each other. Everybody we were all in silos. It took, a lot of dedicated people to make it happen, where today we are so far ahead of where we were. Now, the challenge for us is how do we replicate this across the state, understanding that most other towns and cities don't have the population mass of Portland or even the capital. Even the Portland, I would say, is great for capital compared to San Francisco, but it's still much better off than Medford or Roseburg or Burns. I like the idea of grow our own, because I strongly believe that's what we need. And I'm also one of the very few, I think. I don't believe in getting really big companies, because for a small state like this to have a big company, we get beholden to the big companies. I'd rather create 100 companies with $100 million each than create one $5, $10 billion company, because I think that's what makes for a healthy community. It's what makes for the standard of living which we have, which drives people here. But the last thing we want to do is replicate the mistakes what other folks have made in order to get growth. I think we can create much more stable, sustainable jobs by having lots of small to mid-sized companies than one big behemoth. So there are a lot of opportunities. We've been talking about crowdfunding. I'm sure you're aware that two of the top crowdfunding events companies are in Portland. One is making coolers. He raised $13.6 million crowdfunding. So I think there's an opportunity over that shows the kind of people we have. We have a lot of really talented, smart people, and it's how we enable them across the state, how we show them what's across the state. And that's where I think the state can do a better job. We do spend money. The state does spend money in innovation entrepreneurship. We could always use more. I'm not saying it's enough. We could always use more. But what I see is there's a disconnect. We don't really, we're not very good at marketing the state and all the resources there are. And so most people don't think of going to a state or state-funded resources other than, the Oregon Growth Board. Most people don't know of all the other resources there are. And it's how do we make that available to entrepreneurs, and how do we make them utilize it, and then how do we create that virtuous cycle? I think that's kind of one of the things we really need to look at. We also need to figure out how to boost our opportunities in rural Oregon, right? How do we create what's in Portland? How do we get mentorship more active in other parts of the state? And we can do it. There are people willing to help. I mean, that's the good part of this, is that there's a very capable group of people who are willing to donate their time to make this happen. And we need to figure out what we can do to use that. Let's use some of our economic development departments all over the state. You know, let's use people, let's use agencies we have right now, and let's bring in that spirit of innovation, of entrepreneurship, of being able to adapt and being nimble. We can really increase these opportunities much beyond Portland. We can provide incentives to retain companies. For me, that's one of the big things, is how do we retain companies? When you look at the stage of companies here, you know, there are about three stages, right? The one is the lowest, the folks who are just starting. What they need is cash first and some mentorship. Then there's a second group of companies who are really very stable. They've got 30 to 100 employees. They're growing, and they're growing at a steady clip. So, you know, I think they're good. We need to nurture them. And then there's other group of companies which are really growing very, very rapidly, and they have completely different needs from the first group. For them, capital is not the issue. It's talent. So how do we recruit talent into Oregon? How do we keep talent over here? How do we get internships? What can the state do to utilize some of the money we're already spending to provide internships in these companies so that the companies get talent? Students who come out from our universities have jobs lined up so that they stay in Oregon and not leave, because we're training all these people and then they end up leaving. So how do we keep them over here? How do we provide our companies the talent? Because if we do, these companies want to stay over here. The biggest reason they move is talent. So how do we keep that over here? Yeah, and how do we set a framework for various things? So we talked about the Internet of Things. There's so many areas where Internet of Things can be available. Let's focus on a few, and let's build a framework. I don't mean the state should get involved, but what we can do is let's set a framework for this. Let's set a framework for the UAV industry. You know, let's bring all the players together. Let's work with them. Let's work the state, the various software companies, the hardware companies. Let's build this infrastructure, provide a framework within which they can operate by listening to them. Again, listening to our customers, right? That's one of the first things of being a good entrepreneur, listen to your customers before you go out there, validate your product with customers. And I think we should follow the same. It's very exciting. There's a lot of great stuff happening. Technology, whether we like it or not, is in every part of industry today. And that's the way I think we can grow. These are much better paying jobs. These are more sustainable jobs. And whatever we can do to focus on innovation and really adapting and being nimble, that's the flip side of it, because with innovation comes disruption. You have no idea what unintended consequences are going to happen. So we need to be able to figure out how to adapt and be really and that's no small feat, but I think we can do it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You've given us a lot to think about, and I only regret that we only have about 20 minutes to continue the conversation, but people have got questions, I know. Representative Gallegos.
I'm just curious, particularly with sort of our last part of the discussion, that has to do with, can you either of you comment on, we started talking about sustainability, and I'd like to hear a little bit more about how you think about sustainability as opposed to sort of classic economic development that is wealth development focused only. So how do we move from that sort of old notion to sustainability?
And do you mean sustainability in the environmental sense or something else?
Yeah, well, okay. It's up to them.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when I think of sustainable companies, it's a company that wants to stay in business, that's going to create jobs, that's going to create wealth in their community, not just for their own selves as founders or their investors, but for the entire community. So it even ripples out into supply chains and local purchasing power and those types of things is a sustainable company to me, right? If a company comes in and their eyes are on an exit, which some are, and it's appropriate for some to be, there's a track for that, right? I mean, there's a pretty developed track for that that works pretty well. Those are few and far between. I mean, you can't, in my opinion, hang your economic development strategy for an entire state as diverse as this and as large as this with so many different communities on some hopeful exits. Because the concern is that that money exits as well, right? It exits the community. Perhaps the founders have this newfound wealth. Maybe they even leave Oregon, right? There's no guarantee that they're going to stay. And there's no guarantee either. But the sustainability focus for me isn't really more about industry. It's about longevity and not necessarily about size, right, either.
And if I can add to that, I think most of the people I talk to, most of the entrepreneurs I've talked to, they want to give back. You know, it's, again, for better or worse, we're called a state of do-gooders, and in this case, it's an advantage. People do want to give back, and they want to create a healthy community, because I think at the end of the day, for people of exits, it's much better for us to live in an area which is vibrant, because, again, that's why we move here, right, because we want to create a vibrant community. Just as an example, a bunch of us last week went down to Santa Clara. It was started by private individuals who said, we are going down there to place a booth to recruit people to Oregon. That was the idea. And then we got Business Oregon involved, we got the PDC involved, we got Greater Portland involved, and all of us went down there. It was really successful because what the audience could see, these were about 4,000 entrepreneurs, what they could see was a public-private partnership, and here were companies pitching Oregon. They weren't pitching their product, they were pitching Oregon. Mm-hmm. To come in over here. So I think there is an opportunity, and that's what I think we should tap into. You know, how do we make it, how does the state make it friendlier for these folks to continue doing what they want to do?
Thanks. Representative McEwen?
Thank you, Chair Reed. This is fascinating. Thank you so much for being here today. It's very, very exciting. And I'm looking at your slides, and you know, I think I was born about 30 years too early. I started with a Commodore 128 in my kitchen when my kids were in third grade. You know, I come to this late, as opposed to my children and younger generations. But I'm hearing you talking about the global systemic and meteoric changes that we're facing. And we are a higher ed and workforce development committee. And I'm very interested to hear what your thoughts are on with the rapid changes and the flexibility and the adaptability that we all need to provide for our young people. How does our higher ed system figure into what you're doing, and what are we producing that's working for you, and how can we produce children, young people, young adults who have the skills that you're talking about? Because I'm getting the sense that we're not.
You know, and I think this is one of the challenges I talked about, you know, being what you've got to do now, be nimble and adapt. But then you also got to build structures which by themselves take, you know, 5-10 years. So there's this disconnect, right?
That's right.
So we've got to figure out how we balance that. And, you know, I talked about the youth program we were running. So next year we're going to expand that to Benson because we want to take it to the east side of Portland, give kids who don't have the facility. And what we found is there were these teachers who were teaching tech algebra, I believe. So they had these business projects going, but it was completely disconnected from what was happening out there in the real world. So we reached out to them, and they're willing to learn. And so we're teaching after class now. We're providing this. The Lemelson Foundation is having a meeting at the end of June, which focuses on, you know, different ways of learning, of getting our work, our young, ready for the changing economy, because it's really what you learn today. You know, the curriculum you develop today is outdated by the time they graduate. And so, you know, so how do you change that? How do you adapt to that? And I think, you know, you've got to have the structure, but I think really getting on, looking into the private sector to bring other forms which are actually working, and really having a closer partnership between. It took us 5 months to get a meeting with one of the Portland public schools. That shouldn't happen. When you've got a bunch of volunteers saying, we will come here, teach for free, give our time, get engineers from Intel coming and donating the time, it shouldn't take that long. But that's what I mean by being nimble and being able to adapt.
This is one of the best things about having you on our side now, helping to try to break down those barriers. Yeah. Representative McEwen, you had a follow-up.
Just a follow-up. I think it's more of a comment than anything. And again, what I'm hearing you saying is a bit frightening to me. Government doesn't change quickly. Steering a ship a different direction takes inordinate amounts of time and effort. And if we are producing a higher ed system that is inherently inflexible, it sounds, What do we as a committee, where do we even begin to alter a system that's going to have to do something potentially very different so we're not producing graduates who come out of an inflexible system with a degree that we would love to have great value for this, you know, kind of a flexible future that they're going to have to function in?
I mean, I wouldn't say they're inflexible. I just think it doesn't move as fast.
Yeah.
You know, and for me, that's the problem, is always being behind the curve. And so how do we get other resources? How do the universities and schools partner with other areas and get those resources in? You know, and I think that if we can do that, I still think they need the basic fundamentals. Believe me, everybody needs basic science and math. But how do we get beyond, you know, how do we get them to take those concepts they've learned and move them and be adaptable?
I think if I can comment on that too, the interesting thing is that we have a generation, you know, the millennial generation has never known a world without iPhones, without touch screens, without the ability to be interactive with everything that they touch. And so the paradigm of university and lectures and not getting their hands on things and not being a kinesthetic learner is a real disconnect. And I think more STEM experiences, I wouldn't even say STEM education, but more of those STEM experiences will engage them and help them figure out what it is that they like to do and not what they want to learn or study. What do they like to do? And
yeah. So I'm getting both indications from both of you. Do you have a comment or follow-up on that?
Very quick follow-up, and I'm very intrigued by your comment that we don't need business plans anymore. Is anybody telling our business schools that?
I'm not exactly sure. You know, it's interesting because people still talk about the 40-page business plan, and I don't know any investor who reads that.
Well, it's a little bit like being a legislator, perhaps, when summaries of bills. Representative Gallegos?
Yeah, I'm curious about some of your comments, too. As a professor, I mean, I have to deal with, you know, curriculum. There's never enough room, right? There's never enough room. And so when we talk about, what I'm hearing you say is we need to maybe think about maybe different paradigms for problem solving, different ways of learning how to solve problems. But what I'm also concerned about is I remember in building a college, we used to talk about making sure that we focus on the heart as well as the mind. And I hear you saying that, you know, your notion of sustainability is to give back. Where do you get those values? How do you instill those values in our educational process? Yeah. You know, I mean, it's just, that's...
No, I think it's, you know, and I think I put a little too much emphasis on technology, to tell you the truth. I think the perfect balance is, like I said, I got a degree in government and international studies. Yeah. Had nothing to do with technology. But it's finding a balance. I still think, you know, you need some of those. And we've got to instill those values because at the end of the day, that's what makes it a viable society. So I think we do need that. But I think what we can do, coming back to what Heather was talking about, how do we create this experiential learning, right? So just think of the idea of internships. If we can tell, you know, work with our universities, say, you know, your final year of your engineering and science, open up internships, provide some incentives for companies to get these folks. That's a win-win. Yep. Because you get companies get the talent they need,
yep.
The students get the experiences they need. We just need to find a way to make that happen.
Yep.
That's
good.
Thank you. Representative Reardon.
Well, I'll say it as quick as I can. I'd love to talk to you for another 3 hours. But I also share Rep. McCune's desire to be about 30 years younger because I started a software company in 1984 with an IBM PC that cost me $3,400, and it did have two floppy drives. So it was really nice.
Cool.
Okay, real quick. God, this is just really exciting. I would like to continue this dialogue, if you would be so kind, allow me to work with you going forward. I've been involved with Benson. I know people on the Portland School Board. I would love to help facilitate that in any way. I'm also an advocate for STEM education and career technical ed. I hope we can work together. One opportunity that exists that's not being taken advantage of is career technical student organizations. So DECA, Skills USA, Future Farmers of America, there's half a dozen of them that are state supported. We are starting to rebuild those a little bit, but they're after school / and curriculum in school. They allow businesses and teachers and kids to work together. It's an existing organization. I think we could really leverage that to work, you know, with help the teachers and grow those programs. And that's, I think that would be a good mechanism for you to pursue. So I'd love to work with you and talk to you a little bit further about that possibility, because it's...
That would be awesome.
It'd be great.
That would be really good.
Representative Nierman, you've been quiet. I don't want to call you out, but any questions or comments you want to make?
The technology stuff, thanks for calling me out, but the technology stuff's very interesting. But to me, the reason that we're really here is not because we need the technology. I think the reason we're here is because of economic reasons. And I find myself kind of feeling a little bit that part of it's kind of left behind. Maybe it's because it's the dismal science. You know, the economists don't have a picture of a 3D car or something like that. But I wonder if you do you have any success stories or the state has gone in and watered the seeds or whatever, something like that, and we have now this very profitable company that we're getting a lot of tax revenue from, and they have a lot of employees. That's kind of the economist's 3D car, whatever. So.
I've been in this position for just a little over a month, and looking at really what Kant said, which was really assessing the land throughout the whole state. Truly outside of Portland or one of the research institutes, there's only one established incubator accelerator, and that's in Southern Oregon. So we're the network and ecosystem is not thriving and well-built. There are certainly stories from Portland. You know, there's Puppet Labs and JAMA, and, you know, Kant can name off a whole bunch, you know, that have done really well, that have got a great deal of employees. But our work is to really try and create a better, more cohesive network that connects the hub that is Portland and the rest of the state, and so that they can have those same opportunities and we can have those same success stories. But no, at this point, there haven't been, as to my knowledge, some wonderful, great success stories. I think we're still experimenting.
I think I would add to that just the what I take from your presentation today is that part of your task is integrating a lot of the good things that are happening in separate forms. Mm-hmm. So you know, I could point to success from Oregon Inc., from the Oregon Growth Board, from the Oregon Growth Account, those kinds of things. And part of what I think is exciting about this is the new effort to recognize innovation and entrepreneurship as a cohesive kind of part of Business Oregon's agenda, and the work that they're doing to make sure that they're all connected. I think there's lots of good stuff that's happening. It's not sufficiently connected.
I think earlier we used to be in silos, you know, because like I said, when I was the OGFO, that was one of the things we tracked was how many, you know, what did our dollars get us, right? How much additional capital followed, and how many jobs did they create? What was the average salary of those jobs, because that impacts the tax base. And I can tell you that was very, very strong. And even now with what the Portland Seed Fund is doing is very good. But there are some areas where I think we need to work more, and I think we can be a lot more effective with using our resources a lot more efficiently. And that's where I think we see our big task, is that there's a lot of opportunity, and there's a lot of tentacles all over the place. It's how do we get all of these with one cohesive vision? Because right now we're not there. And I think that's going to be our biggest opportunity, if you will.
And also, you can expect the Oregon Innovation Council will be producing in December, the end of December, an innovation plan for the state that's forward-looking. And so we hope to have some of those stories to tell then.
In part as a result of a bill this committee passed.
So that's right.
Take some credit for that, too.
You put it in 3D.
There you go. Good suggestion. Well, as you probably noticed, committee members are starting to filter out. We're getting close to caucuses meet typically at 10 and that sort of thing. So I don't think it's any reflection on the content that's happening here, just the nature of our busy schedules. So I hope you'll take this as an invitation to continue the conversation with this committee. We're all very interested and excited about what you're doing. And I suspect that we will be eager to have you back during the interim, so you can continue to let us know how we can be helpful as your work continues. So Unless there's anything else to last questions for Heather or Kant, we'll let them go. Thank you very much for being with us. We'll see you again soon.
Thank you.
I'll close the informational hearing. And Victoria, can you remind us of where we're headed next?
We don't have meetings Friday or Monday. I have a draft agenda here for next Wednesday, at which we'll do the work session on 493 if it's ready to go. And then we have an informational meeting.
Do you have a card?
Longitudinal database.
Yep. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We are adjourned.
Appreciate it very much.
Okay. This is the
yes.
Approach.
Yes.
Appreciate it very much.
Okay. This is the
yes.
Approach.
Yes.